I Could Murder a Podcast is proudly part of the Acast Creator Network. For hundreds of extra minisodes and other content, along with our private Discord server and live Q&As, exclusive merch and much more, consider subscribing to icmap.co.uk.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Warning. The following episode contains subject matter and scenes that some viewers may find upsetting, disturbing, or unnerving. Please note, viewer discretion is advised at all times. Sit back and enjoy.
First of all, I want to thank my three oldest children. Obviously, helping us to cope with what's going on. And then there's a young lad called Daniel Stevenson who tried to get in the house the same as myself. And Joe across the road, then the Butler brothers. And then of course there's the four firemen, the police, the ambulances, doctors, the nurses, literally everybody who tried to help save our children, they couldn't. Through our son Dwayne, we're going to donate his organs to save another child, which is what we want, because if you can save another child, that makes us happy. It takes a bit of the pain away. Then poor gentleman from the fire brigade saw what we've seen. You know, my heart goes out to them. It's not just us suffering, it's them as well. It's everybody. Thank you.
Mick Philpott has been given a life sentence and must serve a minimum of 15 years. His wife, Mairead, sentenced to 17 years in prison after killing their six children in a house fire in Derby in 2012. The pair were found guilty of six counts of manslaughter on Tuesday.
Hello and welcome to I Could Murder a Podcast. We are back again. We are back in the studio and I'm very excited to introduce my host for today. It's Ben.
Thank you so much. That's probably the best one yet. Take it.
Well, yes, you should.
Thank you for introducing me. It's great to be here. It's great to be back. Almost halfway through the series. Cases are coming by thick and fast and it's another very upsetting one this week.
It always is. How are you doing, producer Dan?
Yeah, very good. Welcome back, boys. Welcome back.
Thank you, man. For those who are watching us, look at Dan's snazzy hoodie. Mm. Available on the store. New merch. What are you going to do? If they come for you. Doesn't make any sense, Ben.
Super snazzy though, isn't it?
It is a super snazzy shirt. And talking about super snazzy, it's me and Ben, we're not wearing our own merch. Not like Dan, but we're wearing some Gully Garms. So big shout out to Gully Garms.
Yeah, why not enter the codes Kill Ben or Kill Tom for 30% off. Load of lovely retro garms.
You got Ben in a little
shipwreck
mat.
Of the Great Lakes.
And I'm just a bowling champion.
Yeah.
I think I'm a champion.
Tournament.
Just as tournament. But it's a bit glittery, so I'm going to take it. I'm going to take it as a champion.
Yeah. Bronze.
Okay. No, actually gold glitter, Ben. Actually, look at your collarbone, aren't you? It's actually platinum. Oh, my God. It's the champion of champions. Bowling t-shirt. Oh,
it's great to see you.
Jumper.
Ben, I really like your jumper. I've got my eye on it.
Okay.
We both thought he was wearing a t-shirt underneath it, but he's not. It's a high collar. So made Dan like it less, but we'll see where we get to.
I'll still take it.
It's also the kind of top where you could get stains in it and no one really know.
Yeah, which is fine.
Oh, yeah, now you mention it, does look quite stained.
This is the first time I'm wearing it, so...
It's defensive.
No, not defensive. Fact. But it's got loads of shipwrecks on it.
Yeah.
Historical events. So, you know, when it does get to the audience vote, there is a shipwreck that I would like to cover on this channel. So please, Costa Concordia. Please vote. I'm sabotaging the polls already.
Yeah. We'll keep an eye on that. Yeah, that's funny because I actually really want to do Ted Bundy. So I'm going to be voting for Ted Bundy this series. If you guys are keen for covering it, let's do it. Let's do it. I always want to say Tom Brady when I said Ted Bundy. Looked like he had a killer arm, but different context. But yes, Ben, this is a big case indeed. It's one that you've been very fascinated about.
For a long time. Since we started the channel, I've wanted to cover it. And I'm happy to say we're here today to cover it.
Sure thing. You're going to fill your boots. Fill your pot. Are you?
Yeah.
You're going to fill your pot.
I'm going to.
So I'm taking the mic, but do you want to introduce today's case?
So today we are covering the case of Mick Philpot. Few other referred bys, The Nightmare on Victory Road, The Case of Shameless Mick, The Jeremy Kyle Killer.
Misleading.
It is misleading, isn't it? The Father of All Lies, and Britain's Most Hated Dad.
What are we going to go for this one? Shameless Mick works.
Shameless Mick definitely works. I like The Nightmare on Victory Road.
Because it's a bit of a juxtaposition, really, isn't it? Victory, but a nightmare.
Yeah. So, yeah, so lots of names. So, yeah, unsure which one we'll go by.
But what is it about this case, Ben, that's you know, drawn you in?
I think it's very easy to look at the man, Mick Philpot, and go down kind of a... Because he's a larger-than-life character in terms of the television appearances that he made, the newspaper articles written about him. And you can very easily go down kind of the comedic route about him.
Yeah, the articles pre what happened.
Exactly.
He was a bit of a figure of fun before this big event.
Yes, yes. It's a case that's always fascinated me in terms of there are still conspiracies attached to the motive and the actual initial plan before what happened. But the more research I've done on this case... The more research I've done on him as an individual, it's just, there's no other case quite like it. And it is dark and very, very upsetting. And it's just a really fascinating case. There's a lot of layers to it, a lot of elements at play.
So yes, we're going to go into the childhood of Michael, or commonly known as Mick Philpot. Yeah, it's quite an interesting journey to where he ended up, as Ben mentioned. He's a very colourful character. And yeah, we're going to see if there was any warning signs, which in my opinion, there definitely were. And when perhaps times which he should have been prevented from being around the general public, I would say. But yes, we're going to go through his childhood and his early life and see what led him up to this devastating event.
Michael Mick Philpot was born in 1956 in Derby, England. The exact date and time is unknown. He was one of eight children born to Peggy and John Philpot. The Philpots were a large family with traditional Roman Catholic views and way of life. They had immigrated from Ireland to Manchester during the 1940s in order to start a new life in England. Peggy had had two other children during a previous marriage before meeting John, but those children were later taken into care due to neglect. Being the fourth of eight children to Peggy and John Philpot, Mick was rarely the centre of his parents' attention, and their time and energy was already spread very thin, both working full-time jobs whilst trying to raise eight children.
Mick was said to occasionally try to bully and intimidate his mother and other siblings as he grew older, but this rarely worked as Peggy ruled the house with an iron fist, and his older brothers were always ready to put Mick back in his place. Mick's mother Peggy worked 6 days a week as a labourer in a factory, a job that she would hold for almost all of her life before retiring in her 70s. Though she still found time to spend time with her children, she was often straight to bed after making the family dinner once she arrived home from work, which is a polar opposite of Mick, as we'll get on to.
Great work ethic. Peggy.
Mick's father, John, worked as a tradesman and his work would take him all over the country. As a result, he would very rarely be in the family home, often leaving the children to look after one another in his absence. And as we mentioned, there was occasional tension between the Philpot boys.
Despite not having their parents around for the most part, the Philpot family were well liked in their community and said to have been popular with neighbours and locals. Some of the Philpot children did have issues attending school and were on occasion warned by police for antisocial behaviour. But they very much kept to themselves and stayed out of trouble for the most part. As a youngster, Mick was one of the more quiet and reserved of the Philpot children. And whilst many of his other siblings would play out with friends late into the night after their mother had gone to bed, Mick would regularly stay inside and watch television. It is here that before Mick had hit puberty, he was exposed to sexualized and violent television content.
Like Eurotrash.
I remember that, yeah. Channel 4? Probably.
I don't know.
Maybe.
Channel 4 at 10 o'clock? You dare yourself.
Yeah. The wrestling was about to come on.
You got yourself into a few holds that night.
I was 11.
Were you? That's a long time ago.
Mick was introduced to alcohol at the age of 11.
Mick, beer. Beer, Mick.
And this seemed to shift his behaviours and social standing. His older brothers would introduce him to vodka, wine and cider, which is a an interesting mix, which he would also end up stealing from local off-licences and petrol stations. Mick would regularly also drink his father's beers with his brothers and friends.
Cheers, Dad.
Yeah, brilliant. And it is through his newfound friendship circle that Mick would get his first girlfriend, claiming, and there'll be a lot of claims from Mick in this episode, claiming to have lost his virginity at the age of 13. So basically, up until this point, he'd been very quiet, kind of kept himself to himself. He tried on occasion to intimidate his mother and siblings. Didn't really work. As soon as he's introduced to alcohol, he's worked out that stealing it and bringing it into a group environment makes him quite popular.
Which we're not saying to do, by the way.
No, no, please.
Hopefully everyone who's watching this is above age to drink alcohol anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah, Ben? Though he struggled academically at school, Mick seemed to have a fairly successful social life. He had many friends and many girlfriends that he would regularly get drunk and smoke cigarettes with. And whilst he struggled in the classroom, he made sure that he would have success away from school. He would regularly shoplift alcohol and cigarettes for his friends, with some suggestions that this was, for many, the only reason that people chose to keep him around. Just keep him around because he's good at thieving. There's always a kid at the school who was good at thieving.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking, like, one day, I was like, you would get a list from people and, like, what do you want? And I was like, no, I don't know. Come back to me. But there always was that guy, wasn't there?
Thieves.
Thieves. just thieves.
Yeah, there were people who could get things and make things happen. Yeah. I wasn't one of those kids. No. But I hung out with some.
Did you?
Yeah.
That's sick.
Thanks, man.
Mick didn't have an exceptional childhood, either positively or negatively. He was a below average student but had a strong circle of friends and family around him and was never bullied or a bully. He did, however, have some issues with alcohol abuse and theft from a young age, as we mentioned.
And despite his parents both being out of the family home for extensive periods of time, he had quite a stable home life. And this is something, again, that I found quite interesting given what his future home lives will look like. The family did not struggle too much financially, and there was also no physical or sexual abuse in the Philpott household, despite claims that Mick would later make about his parents.
The only thing I'd say is obviously with the mum had two children taken away from neglect beforehand, which you obviously she may have gone on and learnt from that and changed her way, but for me that's a slight red flag.
Yeah, and then she's obviously gone on to have eight more.
Which family. Roman Catholic.
Yeah. Yeah,
but still, it's still obviously a lot of kids, but...
The rest of his siblings didn't go down the path that Mick did.
Mm.
In his teenage years, Mick would have several short-term girlfriends. It has been claimed that these relationships lasted between a matter of days and a matter of weeks, with all of them ending abruptly due to the girls' realisations that a young Mick was extremely quick to anger, highly controlling, had issues with jealousy, was often physically violent, and also became quite possessive. These are traits of Mick's to keep in mind as we progress further into the episode. He may even have refined his skills of manipulation through these various relationships.
Throughout the episode, we're going to talk through different accounts from various partners of Mick's life. Girlfriends, fiancés, wives, and the common trend is that he is described as controlling, violent, manipulative, and domineering. Mick left school at the age of 15 and had a series of odd jobs throughout the city of Derby that he struggled to attend. Like many of his relationships to this point, his employment also seemed difficult to retain. He briefly opted to sign up for income support, but eventually opted out of this due to having to attend the job centre on a regular basis, which wasn't something he felt comfortable to commit to, which is very...
Very ironic, isn't it?
It is very ironic. Mick was and still is an avid Derby County football fan. As a teenager, he would regularly attend their matches and would occasionally travel up and down the country to watch his team play. He would occasionally get into fights whilst travelling to different parts of the country, and there are many photos of him in Derby County shirts.
In 1975, when Mick turned 19, he decided to join the army. Again, he would have issues with attendance and performance, and Mick would also have issues trying to control his temper when confronted by his superior officers. And I got this image of him straight away being told off and not liking it.
Yeah.
Not liking it one single bit. He would often take his anger home with him and take it out on his girlfriends, frequently beating two of his previous partners, one of whom was actually hospitalised. Mick struggled to fit in with the discipline and regiment of the army, and he absolutely despised being given orders as well as the idea of somebody being superior to him, which again is very ironic given what later happens. But Mick was steadfast that he would see it through and try to progress through the ranks with the goal of eventually being superior to others, which is not so ironic. That makes sense.
Though he struggled to fit in with his peers, he would not shy away from any confrontation or bullying with other members of his troop. Mick could very much handle himself and was quite a physically and verbally imposing character. From his football days and time spent fighting in local pubs, Mick had become quite handy when it came to fistfights.
Good pun that, isn't it?
Quite handy.
When it came to fistfights. I giggled when I typed it.
Oh. As well as this, by being deployed to various parts of the country, he was able to meet local women in local bars. And this resulted in him cheating on his partner and getting an underage girl pregnant. He would never go on to meet the baby.
In 1978, when Mick was 21, while stationed in the north of England, his then-fiancée, Kim Hall, sent him a letter ending their relationship, claiming that she no longer wanted to be with him and that she had found love with another man.
Call it a Dear John letter, don't they?
A Dear Johnny. Dear John.
That's like an expensive condom, Ben.
Johnny, you're absolutely spot on there.
You wouldn't know. Bareback sod. I'll pull out, will you?
Fuck. So as a result of this, Mick immediately went AWOL from the army. He got on the next train back to Derby and arrived at the woman's house armed with a knife. This part is fucking spooky, what happens next. He waited until late at night, where Kim's father left the house for work. He then broke into the house and sat silently downstairs for 2 hours.
That is absolutely horrific.
At this point as well, he's 21. This girl, I believe, is 16. And he's essentially waiting for a moment to go and attack this child. He then made his way upstairs to the bedrooms, where he began to brutally attack his former partner with a knife, stabbing her 27 times while she laid on her bed. And obviously, as a result, she started to scream, so her mother came into the bedroom trying to intervene. And as a result, Mick ended up stabbing her before fleeing the scene. So just an absolute... Someone try and break up with you.
27 times.
And the mother got stabbed multiple times as well. Absolutely horrendous.
See, that's part of it when... Because I didn't know a great deal about this case. I knew the end part of the case, obviously. But again, I remembered Mick being thought of as a bit of a figure of fun in terms of things from previous, like before that event. And then you hear that and you're like that's the bit I was like, how would he then be allowed to walk the streets, like, let alone...
Exactly. Because in the talk shows that he'd later make appearances on, he talks about not being able to get employment because he has a criminal record. Mm. And people in the audience are laughing when he says it, but obviously they're probably thinking...
It's a criminal record and a sore hand, wasn't it?
So they're probably thinking he's a scrapper.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is something I didn't know about either. Fortunately, both women survived and Mick was later sentenced to serve 7 years for attempted murder and grievous bodily harm with intent. Though he would only go on to serve 3 years and 2 months of this sentence before being released for good behaviour in 1981.
Fuck good behaviour. I mean...
Attempted murder and he barely served 3 years.
It's so calculated as well how he done it. It's just, as you said, it was such a creepy thought of him just sitting there just waiting.
So, more on this attack. Kim's survival was nothing short of a miracle. She suffered collapsed lungs, a punctured bladder, a punctured kidney, as well as severe wounds to her liver and stomach. This was not the first time that Mick had assaulted Kim, unfortunately. He had previously smacked her in the face with a pool cue whilst at their local pub in front of all of his friends, and that ended up breaking her nose and chipping two of her teeth.
I think that when that happened as well, she then obviously stormed out, but he then grabbed her and made a comeback and watched the rest of the game. And like, the friend's not stepping in even. Yeah. It's hideous. Like, oh, that's kind of how Mick is. And just, a pool cue is just a heavy thing. Yeah,
the back end of it.
When you drop it on the floor, it makes a thud. You think of that around the face. According to Mick's lawyer, he was carried away by jealousy and out of his depth because he couldn't handle emotional relationships. Sadly, this wasn't to be the first instance of violence against Kim from Mick. He had previously hit her in the knee so hard with a hammer that it cracked her kneecap. And this was due to Kim paying too much attention to a baby that she'd been looking after for a friend. That, if you're looking after a baby,
yeah,
I mean, it requires attention. Imagine being jealous of a baby.
Yeah, oh, well, I can imagine Mick being jealous of one.
But that is insane. And he had previously shot her in the groin with a crossbow for wearing a dress that he deemed to be too short.
So basically, the first instance was the pool cue. Second instance was the hammer to the kneecap. Third instance was shooting with a crossbow. And then finally it escalated to stabbing 27 times.
That is. No wonder she just did the letter and didn't say anything to him in his face. But crossbow, I mean, hammer, all of it.
Yeah. But all for such insignificant things. Wearing a dress that he felt was too short. Mm. Looking at, giving too much attention to a baby. I don't know what the thing about the pool cue exactly was. But regardless, it's...
Maybe Phil couldn't pot and she laughed.
That's pretty good.
Mick couldn't pot.
Yeah, he thought she was taking the mick. The attempted murder and subsequent stint in prison set in motion the idea that Mick would never hold another relationship again unless he could fully control the person at all times. Bit of Dharma vibes there.
It's not like he's learning, like you think, oh, he's learned his lesson. Yeah. No, I have to be more controlling.
This is something that he would go on to do with multiple partners in the most outrageous of ways. This girl has said that she's no longer going to be with him, wants to leave him. He does not handle rejection or people leaving him very well at all. And again, this is a pattern that will continue throughout his life.
According to a neighbour, Mick would always have quite a strong reaction if people pushed him or joked at his expense. He never told us that he had tried to kill his ex-partner or that he'd been in prison for it, but it really didn't surprise us. After his first stint in prison, Mick went on to hold a series of short-term and extremely volatile relationships. He would eventually father a staggering 18 children by 5 different women, and he married for the first time in 1986 at the age of 30 to Pamela Lomax. And an interesting note about Pam, she was Mick's eldest brother's girlfriend, and the pair had visited him multiple times whilst he was in prison for attempted murder. He essentially stole Pam from his brother. The pair would go on to have 3 children together, 2 boys and a girl.
And that's the thing as well, the 18 children by 5 different women are the ones that people are aware of. It's speculated widely he could have dozens upon dozens of...
I'm sure not many people wanted to tell their children that Mick was his
father. Definitely, definitely. Mick did not settle there, and speculation is rife with regards to what happened behind closed doors with Pamela and the pair's children. But what we do know is that while still married to Pamela, Mick went on to have 2 more children with a teenaged mistress, Heather Kehoe, who was from Nottingham, who was just 14 years old when she fell pregnant from Mick, who was 37 at the time, almost triple her age. Pamela, Mick's first wife, said that Mick was overly controlling with me and the kids, even when it came to little tiny things. I regularly prayed that he would move on to someone else, and I thank God that he did.
So yeah, Mick apparently was very eager to target people who had no confidence whatsoever. They're either from a very dysfunctional family where they didn't fit in, they felt very unloved, or they had very low on confidence, you know, for feeling like, so any kind of compliment he gave them, like you're beautiful, or he gave any love to them, they really reciprocated to it. Yeah, he targeted vulnerable people. He had a very clear pattern of how he did it. And that's why people fell under his spell so quickly. But then it wouldn't take them long to kind of figure out, you know, the kind of man he was. But at the same time, is a lot of them didn't believe they deserved better. So he was very like, targeting with who he picked.
Definitely, yeah. I did have a quick tangent for you.
Here we go. Interesting facts.
Hit it.
Ben Carter's interesting facts. Interesting facts. Are they? I don't know. Interesting facts. Facts.
So I did think that 18 was a lot. A lot of kids.
There's a lot of kids, Ben.
A lot of kids, isn't it? And I did also then wonder, you know, from that, if there's a lot of Mick Philpott's kids in the world, I did wonder, who has fathered the most children in history?
Genghis Khan.
Yeah. Did you already know that?
Yeah.
Okay, well, other people might not already know that, so I'll educate them.
Okay, because he raped a lot of people.
Yeah. He was a bad guy. So yeah, warlord and conqueror Genghis Khan seems to top most of the charts on most of the different sources available, with a staggering 1,500 to 2,500 children. Another front runner is scientist Berthold Paul Weisner, who basically, via artificial insemination, fathered over 900 children. Very interesting Netflix doc about him. Another big one is Moroccan monarch Moulay Ismail Sharif, with a total of over 1,000.
I thought they said Sharif.
Sharif.
Didn't wear a sheaf.
And then I thought, okay, well, these are all men that have laid with multiple women.
Go on.
I then thought, all right, what's the most produced by one couple? Because that's interesting, right?
That's a horrible copy of that couple of that TV show. Even though I don't think it's the most, but it's in the UK and it's...
Wait until you hear this. So the most produced by one couple is from a Russian husband and wife, Valentina and Fyodor Vasilyev, who gave birth to allegedly 69 children, including 16 sets of twins,
okay,
7 sets of triplets, and 4 sets of quadruplets.
I mean, that's either a very fertile woman or very potent cum. Quick one on Genghis Khan, Ben.
Please. Yeah.
Tom Norris's.
Interesting facts. Interesting facts. Are they? I don't know. Interesting facts. Facts. How many people do you think he killed, roughly, in his reign?
No, far more than he created. I would say probably 1 million.
Dan, do you know? I really looked.
No, I was going to say at least 2 million.
It's 40 million people.
40.
Wow.
40. Yeah, people say he changed the landscape of the world in terms of, you know, that many people, the population. Good. But yeah, 40 million, so
that is actually really interesting. Annoyingly
negative difference there with his kids.
He's trying to make numbers back up, but he's not really.
I just
dropping the ocean.
I can't do it.
So Valentina and Fyodor, yeah, a lot of twins, lots of triplets, lots of quadruplets. And amazingly, 67 of the 69 children for the time as well, which is for the 1700s, 67 of the 69 children survived childbirth. Astonishingly, doesn't end there for Fyodor.
Oh.
Maybe this answers your question about the potent cum.
There wasn't a question about it.
Well, I saw a question mark there. Astonishingly, Fyodor went on to have six sets of twins and two sets of triplets with a second wife.
Jesus.
Bringing his total to 87 children. And this line made me laugh. Although these claims about the Vasilyevs have been disputed, as birth and death records at the time were not very well kept. Mm. However, he is in the Guinness Book of Records. Well, the couple are in the Guinness Book of Records. So there you go. A couple have had 67 children, giving birth to 69.
That's a lot of chicken nuggets.
Christmas must have been.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Yeah. Imagine being the 69th kid and getting the hand-me-down clothes. Like, this is just dust. The toy is just like, what is this even meant to be? Fucking hell.
Brother. You run out of names at that point as well.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Bob 3. Like, what? Fucking, come on, cunt.
Call me Bobby.
Nope, Bob 3. Yeah. Jeez. That's true. You'd run out of names quick.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to one full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Life is full of what-ifs. Some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Very quick, yeah.
Yeah, to be honest, enjoyed those, Ben.
Thank you very much. And thanks for the... I mean, that was a very upsetting fact, but I didn't know that about Genghis Khan.
He's not just a shagger. He's a killer. They always say that about Genghis Khan. It says it on his gravestone. Big shagger, bigger killer.
And back to the episode.
In 1991, Nick was given a 2-year conditional discharge for assault occasioning actual bodily harm after headbutting a colleague. This is alleged to have been because the colleague referred to Nick as a rotten old pedo. Rotten old pedo. Nasty old nonce. You rotten old pedo.
Yeah.
Kiddie fucker. Sorry. Yeah, headbutting someone for calling you in.
Yeah.
A rotten old pedo. A colleague as well.
Yeah.
Where's he working?
He did some occasional sort of cash in hand bits, but very rarely stuck around.
Mm.
But you don't say that. Well, you do say that to someone like Mick Philpott, but not when he's not on a bad day. Because he's going to snap. So with Mick Philpott, life in his 30s became very chaotic. He had gotten married and had 3 children with Pamela Lomax, giving the outward appearance that they were a very happy family. Meanwhile, he has met and groomed a vulnerable 14-year-old Heather Kehoe and gone on to have 2 more children with her. And there is actually online, I found this really eye-opening. A flow diagram of Philpot and his various family trees. And I thought it's a bit more like a family forest than a family tree.
That's good.
For the YouTube watchers, we'll pop an image up for you now. It's really, and there's so many sort of, you know, when you don't have a picture of someone, it's like a grey sort of template. Yeah, it's
When you said Lomax, I thought it was a Cat in the Hat film spin-off. But it's not. It's actually...
Lorax?
Yeah, it could be. Yeah, but there is a PS1 game.
Okay.
Called Lomax, which looks a bit like a moody version of Rayman.
Loved Rayman.
Well, there you go. Might like that one.
Yeah. But yeah, and it's Mick and Pam. Gavin and Stacey, isn't it? Mick and Pam. Gavin's parents. Was that? Because they had a load of serial killers intertwined.
Yeah, they'd Shipman and they had the Wests.
Yeah, that's it. But I don't think this was...
Mick and Pam. They could...
Mick!
Pam.
Pamla.
Cracking boller bombs, Pam.
It'd be very niche.
Yeah, really niche.
Very niche. Well, you never know.
So we've obviously mentioned Heather, who was obviously 14 when Mick got her pregnant. He actually initially met her when she was 13 years old. He was out fishing at a lake in Rainworth, Nottinghamshire, when Heather was at the same lake with her friends. Again, he was 23 years older than her at this point, as well as being a complete stranger to her. So we've got all these images right now, mm-hmm. and it's absolutely horrific what goes on to happen. So he goes on to win her over as he initially begins to ply her with cigarettes and alcohol, a seemingly winning formula from his past.
An oasis.
The story of Mick and Heather is a really curious one, albeit extremely dark. Heather recalled, "He said he loved me. He plied me with cigarettes and cheap Lambrini." Lambrini for the American people?
It's like a shitty cheap wine. We used to drink it when we were young, didn't we, Ben? Like cherry Lambrini, get red lips.
Yes, yeah.
During the fireworks night, I remember.
Oh, wow.
But yes, basically a very, very cheapy wine.
Popular with teenage females.
Commonly used for people underage drinking.
Yeah. "He plied me with cigarettes and cheap Lambrini, but then had a way of making me feel indebted for it."
Oh, it's one of those.
Which is horrific, yeah. You can have this, but...
No, it's usually have it and then it's afterwards. It's like, oh, I gave you that, isn't it?
Yeah, it's not very nice. "He'd use it to put the pressure on to meet him again and again, and I didn't have enough about me to stand up to it. I was still 14 when we moved to a physical relationship. He was telling me how much he loved me. He would play the Robson and Jerome hit Unchained Melody and tell me that it was our song. He said it was our version of marriage because I was too young to marry him, but having sex was what was going to make us properly a couple. He took my virginity when I was 14 in a sleeping bag at the side of the lake after copious amounts of alcohol, and then moaned afterwards about his miserable marriage to Pamela." That is rotten.
Yeah.
Old pedo. "Because I was dating a boy of my age, it became Mick's challenge and he bragged to people, 'I'm popping her cherry before he does.' And he did. Sex could be over quickly, which I was always thankful for, but unfortunately, he would sometimes carry on for hours."
After a few months, the pair began seeing one another up to four times a week, much to the dismay of Heather's middle-class parents, who even attempted to get the police involved in order to warn Heather of Mick's criminal history. Mick had brainwashed Heather at this point and convinced her that this was all lies. In March of 1996, Pamela found out about Mick's affair with Heather when she literally walked in on the pair in the bed together. Pamela immediately kicked Mick out, with Mick then issuing Heather with a following ultimatum. "You got two choices. You can go home and get put in care, or you can come to Derby with me." It's quite the ultimatum. Care or Derby.
A then 16-year-old Heather opted to move to Derby with 39-year-old Mick Philpot, where the pair took up residence at the now infamous council house, 18 Victory Road, Allenton, Derby. This is where the true nightmare began for Heather, and the real Mick Philpot reveals himself. And there are a lot more quotes from Heather here. "Not long after moving in together, Heather falls pregnant. Even whilst heavily pregnant, Mick behaved horrifically towards Heather, raping her at knife point 2 months before she gave birth. And shortly after the pair's first son was born, Mick threatened to smother the baby, who was just 1 week old at the time, briefly holding a pillow over the newborn's face," which is just fucking grim.
Yeah.
"On this, Heather said, 'Mick told me that if I ever backchatted him again, I could kiss goodbye to my precious baby.' And when the pair had their second baby, another boy, Mick beat Heather so severely that she was required to return to hospital just 4 days after giving birth. All because Mick wanted it to be a girl."
And even that makes me shudder. Just because with this character we've described, you do wonder the sinister undertones as to why he wanted it to be a girl.
Yeah, horrible. Absolutely. As well as this, Mick subjected Heather to unimaginable physical and mental cruelty on a daily basis. He forced her to become a 5 times a day sex slave. She claimed to have been forced to cook and forced to clean and also run errands, as well as take on employment as a cleaner at the local East Midlands airport. And this is the weird part, with all of her income generated from that role going to Mick, whilst he sat at home getting stoned.
Yeah, Mick would, it wouldn't be uncommon for Mick to even, you know, hold the house keys of, people wouldn't be allowed the house key. He would pick them up and take them to work. So he'd have complete control, know where they are all day. Then he would only have the house key and let them in and out and stuff. He would be so controlled, and then the money goes to him. In a way, it's like a cult that we covered before.
It reminds me quite a lot of the Colleen Stan case that we covered, in terms of the control. And the just complete way that you can manipulate someone into
being. Then the arrogance of thinking that they're not going to say anything out and about, because you know that they wouldn't at all go against your word. It's very disconcerting. It's important to note that whilst all this was going on with Heather, Mick is also still arguing over the visitation and benefits regarding his 3 children with Pamela. He's been given a restraining order against his ex-fiancee Kim Hall and her mother, and Mick is now also dating and casually sleeping with many other women in and around the Derby area.
The guy's relentless.
I'd say it's a monster.
That's the thing as well. Pamela kind of, well, although she's very happy to get away from Mick, she's not technically, I mean, she's caught him cheating, so she's ended the relationship, but he's not taken it as literally as a rejection compared to the Kim Hall one, but he's still trying to be spiteful over the rights to their children, the visitation rights, so he hasn't taken that very well.
All of the women he is sleeping with are far younger than him, with many of them either having a drug or alcohol addiction or going through various mental health challenges. He truly is going for those most vulnerable. Criminal psychologist Chris Carter said of Philpott's relationship choices, he went for younger girls, usually girls who were very upset, down and depressed, either because they came out of a bad relationship or they were mistreated by their parents. Girls that had no self-esteem, he could pick them out of a crowd. They think that they are ugly, they think they are inadequate, all they need is a little bit of love and for somebody to be there. And Philpott knew how to do that. On her new routine, Heather said, I wasn't allowed any sleep because I had to make up for not having been there during the day. I would arrive home at night after a 16-hour shift and have to cook a meal and do all the housework for him. Rolling his fags became another task of mine. If I forgot to do them the night before, he'd make me get up an hour early to do them. Things got very nasty very quickly. The one time I argued back to him and said no to him, he grabbed a kitchen knife and said to me, tell me no once more, and put the knife to my throat. I did not dare to say no again.
Which is just insane. Another hideous point to mention of the ordeal that Mick put Heather through, we mentioned his attempted murder of his ex-fiancée Kim Hall. Well, Mick actually, it turns out, had a routine of playing Eminem's song, Kim, shortly before any beating of Heather would occur. Heather said, Eminem had a violent song called Kim with a menacing beat and the same name as the ex-girlfriend he nearly killed. It became the soundtrack to his mental abuse, which was even worse than the physical attacks. I often knew hours before I took a beating that I was going to get one, because he started playing that song. There was a look in his eye and a nasty smirk on his face.
That is horrible.
It's grim, isn't it? Yeah. There's so much about this case I didn't know, and just, he is one of the worst people I think we've ever covered. Years of this torture went by, and Mick didn't work a day in his life after serving his prison sentence, living off of government allowance from his 5 children, as well as job seeker's allowance and any income earned by Heather, who he viewed as his personal slave. Mick would stay at home watching daytime television and smoking weed all day, whilst everybody else in his family suffered.
The final straw for Heather came 3 years later when, in the year 2000, Philpott encouraged and almost ordered the couple's eldest son to participate in abusing Heather. The boy was nearly 3 years old at the time. Heather said, Mick backhanded me hard across the face. He was kicking and punching me and had hold of my hair. Then he told my son to tell Mummy what a naughty bitch she was. Mick kicked me again and punched me in front of my son. Then my son punched me in the face and tried kicking me in the stomach. That, I mean, never heard of anything
horrific. Absolutely horrific.
All of this is unimaginable and shows the extent of how Mick not only groomed and manipulated Heather, but had done the same with their child. On this incident, Heather said, something snapped inside me and I thought, I can't do this anymore. I need to get away and get the kids away from that man. And that she did. She left Mick and moved in with her sister, who convinced her to go to the police regarding Mick's behaviours. A subsequent and very bitter 9-month legal battle ensued, with Heather finally winning full custody of her children. With Mick claiming to locals and officials familiar with the case that Heather was some drunken, drugged up dilly lying through her ass.
So he's never wanting his public image to appear wronged or beaten in any way. And yeah, anytime something bad is said about him, he just claims it's lies and tries to swing it whichever way he wants. Obviously, we've used quite a few quotes from Heather here to really paint a picture of what living with Mick Philpott was like. She has done many interviews in recent years regarding her experiences, and she states that although she and her sons are survivors of Mick, Heather, Mikey and Aiden still face trauma every single day. And there was actually part of the interview where she talks about Aiden being basically ashamed to be Mick's son, claiming that he is worried people will think he's like his father, which actually went on to result in the boy not eating for several weeks.
I mean, that's quite common, isn't it, with a lot of, you know, famous killers, their children afterwards, and feeling the guilt and feeling like, have they got any of, you know, that blood or that tendency within them? And like, yeah, it's unimaginable. Like, you never really think about the killer's family.
Yeah.
You think about the victim's family, of course, but then you, it does also...
The killer's family are victims, aren't they?
Yeah.
So on this, Heather said, he got into a temper once and threw Mikey into his cot. He was just 14 months old. Luckily, he wasn't injured. Another time when Aiden was just a week old, he put a pillow to his face in an attempt to scare me. In the year 2000, Mick met a lady by the name of Mairead Duffy. Mairead was 24 years Mick's junior. He met her in what seems to be his pattern, a fairly vulnerable set of circumstances. She had recently given birth to her son Dwayne, and as a result, the boy's father had left Mairead. The child's father had also regularly physically abused Mairead, and Mick decided it was his chance to take over, and so he moved her in to his Victory Road house. Jade, John, Jack, Jesse, and Jaden followed from the pair's new relationship, so they've gone on to have five children together. But meanwhile, he also became involved with mother of one, Lisa Willis, who was a 16-year-old orphan and single mother at the time, and almost 30 years younger than Mick. He doesn't stop.
Mm.
She also joined the couple in the house and went on to have an additional four children with Mick.
So this was essentially before Mick was having affairs and cheating on his then girlfriends and wives, but this time it was actually an open... Essentially, everyone in the house knew the situation. It was what people call a throuple. But it was quite. It wasn't a secret between the two women in the house. They knew what the setup of this.
But it's how word doesn't travel about him. So you've got Kim, you've got Pamela, you've got Heather, two girls and one woman, who have had terrible experiences with him. They've survived him. One of them was nearly murdered. You'd think that the police would either take that into account with what's been said about him, the allegations that have been made. But he's also so quickly able to charm other women and enter new relationships.
Well, like I said, he's picking vulnerable people. A lot of these people may be thrown out and haven't got a place to go. He's offered them a bed for the night. So, I mean, he's picking these people, and he's, like you say, he denies everything, and people want to believe him because he's being nice to them.
Yeah.
How could this nice guy...
Yeah, with all these kids running about that seemingly, you know...
So, it's very tricky. During this time, Mick purchases and parks a caravan in the front garden, adjacent to his Victory Road house, which is now also housing 11 children, a wife and a mistress. Mick will claim that he used the caravan as a love shack, in which he would alternate between his wife and mistress, but never have threesomes with those two at the same time. So he had some rules there.
Yeah.
Although he would have threesomes with his wife and mistress separately, with his male friend Paul Mosley joining him. So he's a character that will come up later on. So yeah, essentially, what's the old expression, mate? If the caravans are rocking, don't come a knocking.
That's absolutely right. And I guess it was because there were so many children in the household that he had to have a means. And it's literally, when you see, he very proudly showed his caravan off in the Ann Widdicombe show that he was on. He literally, you just walk in and there's a king-size mattress and that's kind of it.
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't think he was going on any little holidays in there, was he?
No.
It's just out in the open, and they just, yeah, very, very, very bizarre. Mick and Mairead also had a reputation with the local community for dogging. Ben, do you want to explain to the listeners what dogging is? They don't know what it is.
Not really a dogging expert.
You flashing lights or?
I just had a problem with my car.
Okay.
Yeah, but
there's just people having sex.
See, the thing is, I've heard different kind of definitions of what dogging is. I thought dogging was
you take two dogs, go for a lovely walk.
Yeah, right.
Stop that calf for a slice of cake. But
I thought it was you go park up somewhere random, somewhere sort of isolated, and it's a known area where you and your partner do some stuff in the car while other people watch. But I also then heard, like, the proper definition is that it's actually multiple cars go to this location and sort of all get in each other's cars, and it all gets a bit sort of muddled.
I thought it was the first one.
So there's two. I mean, there'll be some dogging experts in the comments.
Did you see that thing on Twitter earlier about the old girl? There's voice notes on a chat, and basically she was saying, like, this girl was at uni, and she went in her room and it stunk, and she cleaned it all up, And then she was like, kept thinking that some of her housemates pulling a prank on her. And she kept going in there every like day and it would just reek. And then she got really paranoid about her flatmates and she put some cameras up and homeless people were breaking in and having sex on the bed.
Oh.
And then she got the, then I was like, this is bullshit. But then there's like, looked like a still from it. I was like, it's literally from the other guys, isn't it? The car being stolen and being used.
Wow.
For, so
wow.
Just targeting this one girl's room. Let's just keep shagging in there. Bit of a tangent. I thought it was the first one, but
I thought it was. What did you think, Dan? Because you probably know more about this than both of us put together.
I have heard that it's, more people get involved, but I might be wrong. I don't know.
Yeah, I thought it was you do put on a show for the people on the outside.
That's what I thought it was, yeah.
Maybe
I'll do some Googling right now.
But Mick and Maraid, they were very much doing the version where multiple people get involved.
Mm.
I mean, they could have been doing both versions, to
like
be
Destruction
fair.
Army.
Yeah.
In a way. Or Bumbers just knocking and...
Whoa, wing mirrors.
Yeah, and the exhausts. Oh,
leaking.
Brake fluid everywhere. They would regularly park up in the more affluent areas of Derby, where they would have sex in their car in front of strangers and passers-by.
Instead of isolated sort of country roads, they went into really, really wealthy sort of nice parts of Derby.
Yeah, and we're like, have a look at this. Hong Kong. It was later proven that Maraid became pregnant by another man whilst the couple were dogging.
You'd assume that he got into the car as well.
Yeah, unless it was a good shot. 100 and... Maraid immediately had an abortion at Philpott's instruction. They must have done a test.
Yeah, how would she know it's not Mick?
Yeah, that's confused me slightly.
I'm still thinking about dogging.
It looks like it's the voyeurism rather than the engaging and joining other couples.
So I had the right idea about dogging.
Yeah.
Don't clip that.
Yeah,
I thought it was just other people.
Imagine next week wearing a jumper with dogging sights on it. And maybe just written in cum on... Dogging. That'd be nice, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
Get the merch up. Despite this horrible, cramped and highly sexualised home environment, all 11 of the children in the house were said to have been impeccably well behaved, and all of them appear friendly, polite and loving in various media appearances that would follow. There are lots of videos and photos of Mick and Maraid doting on them.
Because that's the thing, you'd expect in an environment like that, being raised in that sort of environment, they'd be little rascals and causing trouble and that, but they're really polite, really well behaved. It's as if they've been raised.
But maybe they are raised in the house of like, you don't want to get on Mick's wrong side.
That's true.
But then I remember hearing that he, later on from another interview, that he loved his kids and he was a good dad.
In 2002, Mick marries for a second time, and this time to Maraid. He was 46 and she was 22. To say that the wedding ceremony was unconventional would be an understatement.
You can say that again.
To say that the wedding ceremony was unconventional would be an understatement.
Yeah, just about.
19-year-old Lisa was one of the bridesmaids and also a live-in mistress of the Philpotts at the time. She was also 7 months pregnant with Mick's child on the day of the marriage to Maraid, with many attendees of the wedding being completely unaware. Over the next several years from 2002 onwards, Mick makes persistent attempts to contact his local council in order for his family of 14 to be moved into a larger council house. Conditions are cramped, with many of the children sharing a bedroom with up to 6 of their siblings at any given time. One bedroom basically has the appearance of a hostel. It's got 3 bunk beds lined up for the Philpott boys, and though some of the benefits are clearly being spent on other luxuries for the Philpotts, including a sports car, a 4x4 Jeep, a widescreen TV, snooker table, on which he regularly had sex with his wife and mistress, video game consoles, and a karaoke machine. Apparently he loved that karaoke machine.
Yeah.
Always see him singing in the kitchen.
There's an ironic thing later on that happens with a karaoke machine.
Oh.
In 2005, an anonymous teenager went to Nottinghamshire Police claiming to have been raped by Mick, though these charges were later dropped, with many believing that Mick physically threatened the girl as well as her family. In 2006, after many years of petitioning his local council for a bigger house with little result, Mick Philpott stuns the country for the first time, and unfortunately it would not be the last, when he decides to contact the local newspaper journalist in a bid to embarrass the council into giving him a bigger house. This bid backfired massively on Mick, as tabloids labelled him Shameless Mick and Britain's biggest scrounger. In various headlines that follow, the whole country turns on him. So yeah, he went to the local paper, and then that story kind of got a lot of attention from other papers, and they all kind of labelled him.
Yeah. It's a bold move, isn't it? House progression up the ladder by embarrassment.
Yeah.
And just...
If you belittling a bouncer thinking you're getting quicker.
Yeah.
Hey, Tiny, you let me in yet? You're not going to get a good reaction, Mick. Yeah, it's a bad tactic, and also, I mean, we're about to go on to just the insane amount of money Mick was on.
Well, that's it. He's like trying to shine a light on all these really cramped and horrific conditions, but watch out for my fucking sports car, and that's my carry. It's my goal on karaoke.
Maybe
next.
Use the caravan for, you know, another bedroom. Yeah. Not, well, for the kids, not for that.
Yeah, obviously. So as Tom mentioned, the whole country turned on. I mean, they were never really on his side. They didn't know who he was, but the country are not massive fans of the Philpots.
He's acting like he didn't have a Philpot to piss in.
Exactly. The articles do not read well for Mick, a man who is receiving up to £60,000 a year in benefits between himself, his wife, and his young mistress. The articles detail how the only income generated for the family is that generated by his wife and mistress. Mick spends his days at home smoking weed, going to the local pub to play pool. I mean, he's got one at home.
So you could say, well, they've been a different game.
Very true.
Thank you.
Breeding his pet dogs to sell their puppies, watching television, and singing on his karaoke machine. The many articles published about the Philpots cause a sensation up and down the country, resulting in multiple invites for Mick to appear on UK television shows. You can only imagine his face when they start coming through. He would go on to make an appearance on Jeremy Kyle in 2006. For the overseas listeners, Jeremy Kyle.
Jeremy Kyle is basically a UK British talk show where people would come onto the show, like kind of talk about the family disputes and the things going on, and they'd try to settle it on TV. But it'd be people who maybe were struggling with mental health issues or coming from, or people who came from poverty. And the host was just a bit vindictive, and they just very much took advantage of it and basically poked fun and would laugh at them a lot. People in the audience, you could see people just laughing, and everyone on there became a figure of fun. I think there was people then afterwards would go on to, some people went on to commit suicide. Yeah. Luckily it got taken off TV because it was such an absolute shit show.
Uncomfortable viewing.
Yes. Yeah.
So he made an appearance on Jeremy Kyle in 2006, This Morning in 2007, and he also would feature on the programme Anne Widdecombe versus the Benefit Society in 2007.
So Anne Widdecombe was an MP for Derby at the time. So yeah, it made sense her seeing him because he was also from Derby. And Anne Widdecombe is a very, you don't want to get on the wrong side. She says what she thinks, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
And also, he says it was explosive.
It was, very worth a watch if you have the time. Yeah, they do not match well. Again, Philpott's plan with these appearances is to embarrass his local council into giving him a bigger house. And there are so many clips from these different television appearances that we can play for you now. So we'll try and pick some of the best ones. But I mean, we could be here for hours. That it's unbelievable. But yeah, there's loads of stuff on YouTube if you want to watch him on Jeremy Kyle This Morning or Anne Widdecombe.
We all work.
You don't work.
Oh, yes, I do work.
Yeah, I know your argument on this. Just give it to us. You say I look after my kids. What's wrong with a man looking after his kids other than a woman?
That's correct. What is wrong with a man looking after his children? I mean, I'm old-fashioned. I believe the man should be at work. But unfortunately, because the media keeps putting a certain story in the paper, I cannot get a job.
You can't get a job because of what?
Criminal record.
See?
I said, you do,
mate.
Why are
you so defensive?
Because when it comes to my kids, I'm very, very
I've just complimented your kids!
After I had a go at you.
I just said that
Listen,
ever
just
since...
Get out, just talk to that, pal. Talk to that. You're not worth it.
I complimented your kids. I complimented your kids, and I sat and listened to you, and all I was saying was how good they looked. You have jumped out of your box with one hell of a chip on your shoulder. You haven't even had anybody say anything to you so far.
I don't have
And you're
to.
Making signs.
I,
no.
I don't have to.
No, 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 no. You've no reason to do that. But I'll tell you something. When a grown man who purports to be a good father, probably he is, sits on national television and does that, no wonder you can't get a damn job.
Oh, there's more. Much more. A souped-up sports car. Plus an expensive 4x4. A brand new kitchen, a widescreen television, and stereo equipment for karaoke.
So, Mick, how are you doing it?
I've got a dog that I breed, which brings a lovely income in.
I think there's no doubt that he deserved the title Shameless Mick. He had no scruple at all about living on benefits.
Widdecombe found Mick three jobs during the show, one of which was with a barrel-making firm. But he did not turn up for work on the first day, and so the job fell through. Widdecombe said that Philpott did not care about anyone, and that he used the word bitch to refer to both his wife and his mistress. Widdecombe also said that she noticed that none of his children sought affection from him. But also we've heard that he was said to have been a very good dad, so I'm not sure. I'm definitely on Anne's side there. He does not handle himself very well at all in these appearances and seemingly loves the limelight. So it's said that he kind of forgot his mission to get a bigger house and just instead was basking in the attention. So regardless of how poorly he is coming across to the public, Philpott absolutely loved being on TV. He almost gets into a physical scuffle with both Jeremy Kyle and Anne Widdecombe on each appearance.
A triple threat match I'd like to see.
I would watch that, yeah. The backlash that the Philpotts...
Isn't Backlash a wrestling event?
It is an event, yeah. It's a big sort of pay-per-view, I think.
A pay-per-view, yeah.
Yeah. The backlash that the Philpotts face as a result of these appearances is significant, not just for Mick, but for his family also. His children are bullied relentlessly at school, and his wife and mistress are teased in the streets of Derby. Some of his children become depressed as a result, and again, Mick's paradal pursuits of being moved into a bigger house have failed.
Whilst this is happening, Mick's wife and mistress both fall pregnant and eventually give birth to Mick's 17th and 18th child.
There's an interview with Mick. I swear it's one of his friends just filming him. It looks like a vlogger type situation. But there's an interview with Mick shortly after the 17th child is born, but just before the 18th was due. And he basically is like, I'm Mick Philpott. I do what I want. You don't like it, you can go fucking sit on that. But he's like, it's like a promo, like a wrestling promo. And it's, I shouldn't laugh, but it's quite powerful. So we'll play that for you now.
Quite powerful.
No, sorry. It's
cringy.
It's very cringy, very eye-opening. It's very cringy. I'm just going to stick at that.
So, powerful.
Not powerful. I didn't mean that. It's powerful in terms of the word choice.
At this present moment, I am on cloud nine. I'm buzzing. I've just had child number 17. I've soon come to child number 18. There's going to be a lot of people out there that's going to say, oh, look, the scum, the scrounger, the shameless Mick has done it again. Well, I'll tell you what, fuck all of you, because at the end of the day, my life, my wife's life, Lisa's life, we do what we want. We don't care what you people think. At the end of the day, we're happy, so stop the lot of you.
Despite Mick's many efforts in the entire country turning against him, he doesn't receive the housing upgrade that he desires. And in a chilling revelation, he states to a local news crew that he will build an extension on his house into the back garden, regardless of receiving planning permission from the council. He states, one way or the other, I will get what I want, which is quite haunting given what will happen next. And now we're going to move on to the timeline of the nightmare on Victory Road.
11th of February, 2012. After years of abuse, Lisa cannot take the wrath of Mick Philpott anymore. She knows that she must leave for her own safety and her children's. Lisa cannot even confide in the woman she has shared her partner and house with for years. She tells Mairead that she is taking her children to the local swimming pool. Her five children pack their swimming costumes and towels and leave carrying only the bags on their backs. Lisa and the children would not return back to 18 Victory Road that evening. Instead, they flee to a women's refuge. When Mick realizes that Lisa is not coming back, he becomes engulfed in a fit of rage. As a result, he blames Mairead, telling her that it is her fault and that he must find Lisa. Mick, now aged 56, barrages Lisa with a bunch of calls and texts, pleading for her to come back to his clutches. Of course, Lisa ignores these attempts at communication, thus further frustrating Mick. He begins threatening Lisa and hurling abuse at her, but his attempts fail, as Lisa has escaped the fists of Mick Philpott. Lisa filed for full custody of her children immediately. She knew she could not let that man come near her or her children ever again. A custody hearing is set for the 11th of May, 2012.
So yeah, she did that in the way, obviously, she knew not to say it to Mick's face, obviously knowing how violent he could be and how controlling he was. She did it probably in the best way she possibly could, just, you know, leaving and just making a getaway, essentially. She obviously had had enough at this point and just thought, it's my time to leave.
Textbook, isn't it? Textbook.
So about a month later, on the 10th of March 2012, police are called to Lytton Drive, Spondon, Derby, after there is a confrontation between Mick, Lisa, her sister Amanda Cousins, and her brother-in-law Ian Cousins. Very confusing with the brother and cousin has been the last name there, Ben. It nearly tripped me up.
It nearly did.
It didn't. On the 17th of April 2012, a court hearing is held over a non-molestation order against Mick. Lisa does not attend the court hearing, although her presence is expected.
A non-molestation order is aimed at preventing your partner or ex-partner from using or threatening violence against you or your child, or intimidating, harassing, or pestering you in order to ensure the health, safety, and well-being of yourself and your children.
So it's kind of like a what's
restraining
the word?
Order.
Yeah, restraining order. That's the one. Yeah,
it's just worded non-molestation. I thought you can go near them, but you can't
I didn't think that. It becomes known that the two had been in contact the day prior to the court hearing. The non-molestation order is revoked.
A month later, Mick devises a plan to make sure that Lisa will not win the custody battle. He tells Murray that he will set the house on fire whilst the children are sleeping in their beds. He will make sure the neighbours are convinced Lisa has done this. There will be a ladder pinned up against a wall in the garden so that when the fire inevitably breaks out, he can smash the window and save the children. Ultimately, he would look like a superhero dad, leaving Lisa without her children. The thing about this is he doesn't even think beyond his arrogance. He doesn't think beyond these facts. Ladder, window, smash, get the kids out. He's not thought about how I'm going to frame Lisa,
yeah,
apart from his word that he feels people will believe.
Yeah.
Doesn't even look into what Lisa's doing that night.
No.
So, yeah, very short-sighted from Philpott. Mick reassured Mairead by telling her that the children will be safe. Mick thought that his plan was foolproof. Mairead agrees and, without squabbling, puts her children's safety at risk. Not only will this solve his issue with Lisa, but will also resolve his issues with the council. Without a house to live in, the council would be forced to give him a bigger one. This is so elaborate and putting so many people at risk. Why not just do the old leaky gassy oven?
The old leaky gassy oven.
The house goes down. Oh, someone's left the gas on.
Why risk the kid? Like, do it when they're out.
Yeah.
It's the arrogance. He's like, well, I'll be able to smash a window and save all the kids.
Yeah, I'll look great.
Yeah.
If anything, might even win Lisa back.
He's trying to frame her.
He might have crossed his mind, though.
I don't think he would.
I'll frame her and then I'll win her back.
Yeah, she'd be like, oh, I did do that and he saved the kids. Now I'm in love with him again.
Yeah.
Not going to happen like that, Ben.
No, but implementing his hatred for Lisa, Mick has spent the days beforehand making sure he has given enough evidence so that people will think this is the work of Lisa. He has been writing on Facebook, telling online of his detest for her because she is an awful mother. Pot, kettle, black.
Phil Pot, kettle, black.
He tells the public that she has cheated on him, and he even called the police to file a harassment charge to further solidify his plan.
He is very much a person who would air dirty laundry on Facebook.
Yeah, absolutely.
Have you seen what Mick said again? Take that phone away from him. On the 10th of May 2012, earlier in the day, Mick purchased canisters of petrol. After making his purchase, he heads home and waits for the events of the evening to unfold. Mick and Mairead invite their companion Paul Mosley over. They tell Paul of their plan, and Paul agrees to help with the arson attack. The trio then become intoxicated with both drink and drugs, and they participate in a threesome on the snooker table until it reaches about 3 a.m. So they're potting all the balls there.
The 11th of May 2012. At 3 a.m, they compose themselves and begin to pour the petrol cans all over the floor. They focused on the hallways near the front door in an attempt to make it look as though the petrol was poured through the letterbox, which is just... very strange. Once all the petrol has seeped into the carpet, Paul leaves, taking the petrol cans with him. He then disposes of the evidence. At 3:30 a.m, 999 receive a distressed call from the Philpotts. They tell 999 that a fire has broken out at their household. Conveniently, Mick and Mairead have escaped the fire and are waiting in the front garden. Mick would tell police that he and Mairead were asleep when the fire broke out. So we'll play a bit of that call for you now.
The house is on fire, my kids are in bed.
Yes, what address?
18 Victor Road, Mrs. Philpott.
Mrs. Philpott? My kids are in the house, Mrs. Philpott. Where are they?
I'm sick of them.
Are there any flames there?
Oh my God, please.
All right, we've got the fire service coming on the way.
I can't get them back in the kitchen room. I'm sick of them.
Is it a terraced house? Yeah, but we've got the police on the way. Have you any idea what's caused the fire?
I've never had any idea, but it's woke up by day long. There's
smoke everywhere.
We're like, geez, God, my baby's all upstairs. I can't get out.
Okay, what's your name, please?
I'm Gavin Teddy. There's no noise to be children.
And one of the things as well, when the fire was lit, obviously the fumes of the petrol catch a light as well, but they had painted, they've done a bit of a cheap job basically on the stairway, and they painted it with yacht paint, which is extremely flammable. So it was basically designed without, I'm sure they didn't know that aspect of it, but that just went up, you know, very, very quickly indeed.
Neighbours begin hearing the screams of the Philpotts and they rush over to provide help in any way possible. One neighbour, named Joe Peel, said, "I heard his voice. I couldn't hear anything else and I couldn't get in because it was just flames and smoke." A couple of minutes later, the fire brigade came down with the police. 2 or 3 minutes later, you could see the flames going up the stairs through the side of the window of the house. When the fire brigade came, it was billowing smoke going up the road. It was absolutely horrible. And this Joe Peel, as well as another neighbour, are in a lot of the documentaries about this case. And they are just still to this day so much trauma.
Yeah.
So visibly moved by.
Yeah, they heard and so could obviously see what was happening. They ran over to try and help, jumped over the caravan, went to the back of the house. I think one of the boys actually went into the house, but they couldn't see past the smoke and could hardly breathe. So they had to leave. And yeah, as Ben said, you could see how cut up they were and how, you know, it affected them today.
And while they were trying to break into the house and get there, they saw Mairead and Mick just kind of like frozen and they assumed it was shock. And maybe it partly was because they didn't expect it quite to go to this extent, but they weren't doing anything to try and get to those
children. But there's also was the ladder leaning against the back of the house, wasn't there?
By this point, the whole house has become swallowed by flames. Some jump onto the caravan in an attempt to climb through one of the windows on the side of the house and rescue the children. A ladder can be seen placed against one of the walls of the house, which led to a smashed window. So this is in the rear of the property. Mick climbs the ladder and pretends he is making an effort to save his children. Even he is taken aback by the blaze. The smoke is too thick, many hearts break as the neighbours cannot save the 6 little children sleeping in their beds. Emergency services are quick to attend the situation. Unfortunately, they are not quick enough. As they enter the house, they wrap the children in blankets and carry them carefully to the garden. Here, paramedics attempt to resuscitate the children, but 5 of them are pronounced dead at the scene. A coroner's report finds that they died from smoke inhalation. It is more common to die from smoke inhalation than it is to die from burn injuries. If any comfort can be found in this case, it is the fact that the children most likely would have been unconscious before they drew their last breath, so it is likely that they just went to sleep and never woke up. When emergency services arrived at the scene, firefighters quickly suspect that this has been an arson attack. The devastation caused by the fire was not consistent with a natural fire because the whole lower floor was ablaze. In a natural fire, the flames are carried upwards, not across, as seen in this scene. This had now become a murder investigation. Lisa Willis and her brother-in-law are arrested for the arson attack. It looks like Mick Philpott made valiant attempts to save his children, as said by Assistant Chief Constable Steve Cotterill.
Specially trained dogs came in, who arson dogs, who were able to tell what had been, if there's areas which had been used with fuel or whatnot. So they came in, the dogs quickly identified the area where the petrol was poured. Wow. So they quickly knew it was an arson attack. And obviously from that, you would have thought, oh, Mick's got his way here because Lisa's been arrested.
It's all going to plan.
Yeah. On the 12th of May 2012, all reports of Lisa creating the fire stemmed from the rumours Mick had been spreading whilst his children were suffocating to death. Lisa's children were taken from her while she was under arrest. Lisa has a strong alibi. Police quickly realise this is not their killer when Lisa's story is corroborated by others. Lisa and her brother-in-law, Ian Cousins, are released without any further action taken against them. Lisa's children are given back to her. The deceased children must be identified following standard procedure. Their parents, Mick and Mairead, are asked to identify their bodies. Mairead is in hysterics. She cannot view the burnt bodies of her dead children. Knowing they cannot face this alone, their neighbour, also named Mick Russell, is asked if he could come along with them for moral support. Being a good friend, Mick Russell agrees. Luckily, Dwayne was found to be breathing once he was carried into the garden away from the smoke. Once his discovery has been made, he is rushed to Birmingham Children's Hospital. Once he arrives here, he is pronounced as being in an unstable condition. So as you can imagine, with Mick Mairead, obviously, You can imagine if that was, you know, let's say the fire had broken out and they had nothing to do with it. You've got one surviving child out of the 6 in the house. You're going to be by the bed. You're going to be worrying. You know, you're not going to leave the side. Nothing's going to make you leave his side, you would have thought. But this behaviour here is absolutely baffling. And also, one could view, like you said, there's a lot of different theories about this. Mick wasn't planning to kill his children.
No.
The devastation of losing his children should very much be prominent here.
Yeah.
He didn't plan to do it. And even you could argue if he did plan to do it, he's still losing the children that apparently he loved. This bit is just absolutely baffling. Throughout this time, Mick and Mairead are putting on the act of being the concerned parents. However, when asked if he would like to go with Dwayne to the hospital, Mick tells the people around him that he better not, as he has to be up early in the morning for his court hearing.
Absolutely insane.
Moreover, Mick has been quick to make accusations. Whilst his children are dying in their beds, Mick makes it known to the people around him that Lisa Willis has caused the house fire. At every available opportunity, he badmouths her. As the people of Derby wake up, the news is spreading of the horrific deaths that have occurred at 18 Victory Road. The community is quick to come together and a GoFundMe is set up in order for people to donate money to pay for the children to have proper funerals.
The other thing that's really horrific about this is whilst Mick was at hospital with Dwayne, he was in the corridors flirting with nurses. Apparently he slapped one nurse on the arse.
Yeah, apparently he even invited one of the policewomen who were there back to the hotel. So yeah,
whilst your son is on his deathbed.
Yeah, yeah. He was making jokes, apparently, when they went to identify the bodies, he was making jokes, and his friend Mick was the one in tears, and he wasn't. He was comforting Mick, his friend. And it's like, yeah, again, like we always say, people deal with grief differently. Mm-hmm. Flirting with nurses,
slapping a nurse's asses when going through grief.
You'd be by your son's side the whole time, and could you act more guilty? Mairead could not enter in the room which her children lay deceased. As a result, the two Micks go into the morgue alone. It has been reported that upon seeing the children's lifeless bodies, the neighbour was more upset than their own father. Mick even denied time alone with the children to say goodbye. Which, again, is admissions of guilt, you could argue. Once the two Micks have identified the bodies, they meet Mairead and drive to Dwayne. He's unresponsive, in a coma, and placed on a life support machine. Whilst at the hospital, neighbour Mick is shocked to find that he is more upset than Mick and Mairead. In fact, after the couple have disappeared for an extended period of time, neighbour Mick left Dwayne's bedside to go and find the pair. When he saw Mick, he witnessed him explicitly flirting with the nurses. He even went as far as to pinch one of the nurses' bums, whilst commenting, "This is what I like."
Mental.
This would not be the only occasion where the pair acted disgustingly. When the nurses come around with the food for the patients, Mick and Mairead ask if they can have a plate. They are denied as the food is explicitly only for the patients. So even in the hospital is asking for a handout, they can't. Mick and Mairead make it actively known that they find this despicable. Mairead even tells a nurse she can have her son's meal as he's not going to eat it.
Fucking hell.
Yeah. It's like going to the blind ward and taking all the pictures down. Kind of.
Yes.
Despite being reminded that they can purchase food from the hospital's canteen, Mick and Mairead decide to order Chinese takeaway to the hospital. The food ended up mostly on the floor as they had a food fight over Dwayne's comatose body. I mean, they're just... You can't think they could go any further with being...
Sink any lower.
The hospital staff were then made to clean up the mess. So yeah, even if by this stage the police hadn't suspected them...
Everyone that encounters them now...
Yeah. A food fight over your comatose son, the only living member of the children that you just killed.
May the 13th, a decision is made to turn off Dwayne's life support by the family. It has been reported that Mick and Mairead were by his bedside as he took his last breaths. May the 14th, police make it public knowledge that Dwayne has passed away. The general public is affected majorly by the death of these children. Derby is described as being a tight-knit community and any death would have affected them, but this sent shockwaves across the area. Dwayne was described as gentle and caring by his head teacher, Christopher Reynolds. He also added, "The things people remember about him are all nice, positive things. He genuinely was a really nice lad." In the end, the money raised from the GoFundMe would total approximately £15,000. The intended use of this funding was to pay for the children's funerals. Yet once again, Mick and Mairead have received the cash, and it is used in a very different manner. Using the GoFundMe money, Mick and Mairead decide to go on a shopping spree. Although it is true that their house has been destroyed by a fire, the majority of the money is used for their personal expenses rather than paying for the funerals of their children, which is just disgusting. This raises anger and suspicions within the community. The police begin to receive tip-offs that the Philpotts are acting unusually.
We always compare it when people go on a spending spree after death to the Menendez brothers. But they also went to a pub and they did karaoke. This is what I'm saying about the karaoke thing. And they sang Suspicious Minds, which is very ironic. We're going to go into this. This is where the police are obviously starting to think something has gone awry here.
At no point, and we'll probably talk about this more when he goes into his press conference, but at no point are they saying, "You need to find who did this. You need to find who killed my babies." It's not mentioned once.
Yeah. He doesn't seem too heartbroken, at least being in and out. You know what I mean? It's like she went in because obviously was spreading the word, and then she's been proven innocent. And it's like, he's just like, "Oh, okay."
But you'd even think, even if this wasn't his plan, but the children were still killed by this fire, he would have a natural sentiment or yeah. some empathy, but he's not. So that you'd think this may help him even cover it up further if there was some kind of natural emotion from it, but there's nothing.
So the 15th of May, 2012, since the fire, Mick and Mairead had been moved into the Premier Inn. Police tapped their hotel room in the hopes they would find concrete evidence from their new suspects. Exactly that happened, but only after a while. Police began to grow suspicious of the fact that the house fire was rarely even brought up by the pair. They were not expressing grief for their children or even mentioning them. Moreover, when Mairead tried to talk to her husband about the situation, she was silenced. 4 days after the hotel room was tapped, police hear Mick tell his wife that she must stick to her story.
So during this week or so that they had bugged the Premier Inn room that they were staying in, Paul Mosley visits them.
Yeah.
And
so he was the guy who was in on the fire with them.
Yeah, he incriminates himself quite heavily when he arrives there, but then also Philpott orders Mairead to give Paul a blowjob and show him a good time, which she then does. And Mick Philpott can be heard in the background saying, you know, he deserves this. He, you know, show him a good time. And it's just, yeah.
Yeah, I think he came over because he was worrying that they're going to be found out, Mosley, and everything. Mick was paranoid about Mosley saying something. Soon. So he basically used Mairead in order to give him a sexual favour, in order to keep him quiet. And then afterwards, you can hear Mick saying, thanks for doing that. I know you didn't want to do it. Which, again, just shows the manipulation there that he's using on his
wife. 16th of May, 2012. The next day, police receive a request from Mick Philpott. Mick tells the police that he would like to do a press conference to appeal to the public in the hopes that someone will be able to shed a light on the creation of the fire. Although they are suspects, the police allow the press conference to go ahead. This is in the hopes that one of the two will say something damning and confirm their suspicions. This press conference would go on to be very, very infamous when it comes to the Philpott case. Throughout the interview, very few tears are shed, and in fact, no tears are shed from Mick at all. Furthermore, Mick barely acknowledges the children he has just lost. He thanks the emergency services and neighbours before the names of his children are even uttered. He tried to put on a persona of a grieving parent, but in actuality, the only thing wiped from his face is a smirk in which he tries to conceal. They also kind of regularly look at each other whilst also pretending to cry, as if they're looking at each other to encourage each other to stay in the role.
I watched that program, Faking It, this case, which it's a good show to watch. Where they have a lot of people, experts about body language and whatnot, and there's a bit where Mick walks into the press conference with his back first, which is in the sense of, you know, it's kind of...
doesn't want to face up.
Yeah, but it's a strange thing to do. And then the fact they keep saying about, he's dabbing his eyes with a tissue.
It's all the tissue there,
but then it's you can obviously see he's not crying. Yep. And his face, they said Mairead actually shows with the crinkles in her forehead that she actually is upset and she's grieving. Yep. But he's not at all, and it's actually pushing the tissue into his eye, trying to create tears, it seems.
Yeah, make his eyes red.
Yeah, and it's very bizarre. And the language he uses, he thanks his surviving children who have helped him and the fire services, but he never once says
find who did this.
And which, the whole point of him doing it, the public appeal, you would have thought was that's exactly why he's doing it.
So yeah, people have likened it to that of a toddler trying to sort of fake a tantrum or fake cry. He literally just keeps holding a tissue up to his face. But there are lots of very famous moments from this press conference. We'll play some parts of that for you now.
I want to thank my three oldest children because they are helping us to cope with what's going on. And then there's a young lad called Daniel Stevenson who tried to get in the house, the same as myself, Joe across the road, and the Butler brothers. And of course, there's the poor firemen, the police, the ambulances, the doctors, the nurses, literally everybody who tried to help save our children, and they couldn't. Excuse me a minute. We've decided that through our son Dwayne, and unfortunately the last one to pass away, that we're going to donate his organs to save another child, which is what we want, because if you can save another child, that makes us happy. It takes a bit of the pain away. And we can't express our gratitude to everybody that's been concerned with the case, with what's been going on. I've actually been down to our home, and what we saw, we just cannot believe it.
Wow.
Yeah, It's, yeah, really infamous. The journalists within the interview room are baffled by the behaviour of Mick and Mairead Philpott. I don't think so much Mairead, but certainly Mick. Moments before the turning on of the cameras, Mick and Mairead are laughing with reporters and seem in good spirits. During the interview, Mick contradicts himself. Not only does he ask for members of the public to come forward with information surrounding the case, but he then tells them to leave him and his wife to grieve in peace. There's a very, very infamous photo actually from this, because obviously the police were kind of had them in mind as suspects anyway. Yeah, there's a very famous photo where you basically see Philpott kind of holding the tissue up to his face, and you've got PC Steve Cotterill, who's one of the leads on this case. This PC Steve Cotterill is literally kind of glaring side eye at Philpott. Yeah, it's a very famous photo.
Very famous.
Yeah.
Big case.
Big case. He tells the public, please leave my family alone. If you've got any questions or anything at all, please don't come through me and my family. Please go to the police. You're disrupting what these officers are trying to do. So please, I beg you, leave us alone and let us try and grieve in peace and quiet. Which is such a different message to usually if you have parents of missing children or murdered children. It's please tell us anything you have. Yeah. Come to me. We need to find out.
True fire. Oh, maybe. Couldn't get the word right.
Come to me. Come, my baby.
You're my sugar fat. Butterfly!
Baby. The public has heard stories of Mick and Mairead acting out of line, and a public spree of hate is spread. At the same time, Kim Hall, Mick's first fiancé, is sat at home watching this with her mother, both of whom were stabbed by Philpott, adamant that Mick is to blame, and I'm sure a lot of his previous relationships were, as soon as they see him do a press conference like this, must immediately have had a high level of suspicion.
May 29th, 2012, Mick and Mairead are arrested after police gather all the evidence confirming their suspicions. On the 30th of May 2012, the couple is charged with 6 counts of murder. On the 20th of June 2012, Paul Mosley, aged 45 at the time, is arrested for his involvement in the arson attack. He is later released on bail. On the 22nd of June 2012, Duane, Jade, John, Jack, Jesse and Jaden are all laid to rest in the joint funeral on the 22nd of June 2012 at St Mary's Catholic Church. They all had matching white coffins. The boys had blue flowers, whilst Jade was buried with pink ones. All the coffins had the child's photographs placed upon them. As well as the photographs, the children were buried with toys or something memorable to them. Guests wore bright colours to try and bring some hope to such a bleak day. More than 400 were present at the funeral. These deaths shook the country to the core, and people felt they needed to pay their respects to the children who lost their lives and were taken too soon. Mick and Mairead were not allowed to attend the children's funerals, and the money they had not spent on themselves were used to pave the headstones for the children. Jade Philpott was 10 at the time of her death. Her brother John was 9, Jack was 8, Jesse was 6, Jaden was 5, and Duane was 13.
So yeah, so that was the timeline for the Mick Philpott case. We're now going to go on to a little bit of aftermath. So although this was originally a murder case, in December 2012, the charge was dropped to manslaughter. The deliberate attempt to place a ladder outside the window suggested that the intention was never to kill the children. Therefore, it was a manslaughter charge rather than murder. Although many online have argued that this was a charge not harsh enough. On the 5th of November 2012, Paul Molesley is arrested for his role in starting the fire. Forensic tests are conducted on Mick's, Mairead's and the children's clothing. All of the children were found to be in daytime clothing, not pyjamas as we would expect sleeping children to be in. Forensic tests reveal that Mick and Mairead had petrol splashes on their clothing, and so did Paul.
On the 17th of December, all three pleaded not guilty, meaning a trial would have to take place. On the 12th of February 2013, the trial commences. During the trial, Mick takes the stand. Whilst under oath, Mick makes outlandish remarks such as the participation in dogging and his sexual fantasies. As many have remarked, this was just another performance for Mick Philpott. As Jeffrey Wansel commented, he may have convinced himself, but he didn't fool everyone else. On the 2nd of April 2013, Mick, Mairead and Paul were all found guilty of manslaughter at Nottingham Crown Court. 2 days later, on the 4th of April 2013, the individuals were sentenced. Mairead and Paul each received 17 years, and Mick was given a life sentence with a minimum of 15 years to be served. He's currently residing at Wakefield Prison.
I just cannot see any chance that he's released.
Oh, I mean, he's the first stabbing, 27 stab. I don't understand how that he did 3 years.
Yeah.
They got 17 years each, and he got 15 years.
Yeah.
Which is, yeah. We did a Instagram post of him being worked for a prison playing ping pong with Ian Watkins.
It's a very bizarre friendship.
Apparently Ian Watkins, who he previously covered, the ex Lost Prophet singer, he apparently plays ping pong with Philpott in prison.
Yeah, a bizarre one. I actually have a friend that has recently taken on a new role at Wakefield Prison as a teacher in the women's wing. So I'm going to try and get some gossip. Big prison. Try and get some gossip. See if I can find out who's winning the ping pong.
Please do.
Yeah, I reckon Philpott, quite an aggressive ping pong player. In September 2013, 18 Victory Road was demolished. Maraid controversially was released in 2020 on licence. Poole was also released. It is thought that once she was released, she was placed into a hostel and placed under strict supervision. At her sentencing back in 2013, Maraid was told by the judge, "These were your children. Your first responsibility surely was to them. Instead, you joined in with his plan." Maraid had previously attempted to appeal her sentencing. However, she was denied as she had not served half her sentence, as the judge had ordered. And it was agreed that her sentencing reflected her callous actions. Those who live within the Derby area have been reassured that she will not be returning back to the area at any point. As MP Pauline Latham commented, 8.5 years in jail amounts to her serving less than 18 months for each of those poor children. How can that possibly be right? Those in charge of making these decisions need to think longer and harder about the victims and the value of their lives.
Her release has clearly caused some upset, not within the local community, but furthermore within the Centre of Crime Prevention. Maraid's early release has left people questioning whether justice can be served if a criminal does not serve their full sentence. As David Spencer, the research director for the Centre of Crime Prevention, said, "The system of automatically releasing criminals like her halfway through their sentence means that in cases like this, justice is not being done. This needs to change. For crimes like this, those convicted need to serve their full sentence." It is thought that Maraid has been receiving counselling and coaching since her release. She is also now living under the protection of a new identity. She's living in a charade. And that is the horrible case of Mick Philpott, the nightmare of Victory Road.
Yeah, there's a lot more to that case than I was initially aware of. Yeah, yeah, but a very bleak one, a very dark one. And hopefully he never, ever, ever gets out.
I don't think he will.
I don't think he will either. I don't see, even with new identities, very recognisable. Well, he would need some serious...
Ben, talking about his looks,
well,
we seamlessly go to a look-a-luckies.
What does it look like? That looks a bit like that.
It looks a bit like this.
Do you want me to start, Ben? Because mine aren't overly good. Surprise people.
Yeah.
Going to start with one that... It's the eyes, I think.
Yeah.
It's the eyes. Okay. I'm going with... Famously from the comedy duo, Cannon and Ball.
Oh, my God.
Bobby Ball.
That's who my dad said.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, there you go, Kev. That was for you.
Well done. I'm happy with this one. I think that Mick Philpott would be the third Funk brother as part of wrestlers Terry Funk and Dory Funk. You wouldn't know. I've just put the three of them there, look.
In a way.
Yeah, thank you, yeah.
I would just probably say it looks a bit like Terry Funk.
Terry Funk, yeah. Yeah. Thank you.
A bit. This one, I think, is probably less good. I mean, the first one wasn't particularly good. Tim Healy from Alphidus and Pet, or Benidorm.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Also, the lead singer of 1975's Dad.
Yeah, he is.
I think he could play him.
Yes.
But maybe doesn't look too much like him. It's just mainly a bald head with a bit of a beard.
Well, on bald head and bit of a beard, I've gone for, from the side, old Eric Cantona.
I mean, if you're going to have to say it from the side, it's going to ruin it, but go on.
Well, from the side, old
From the side,
Eric.
From far away.
in natural light, old Eric Cantona. Although, when I did that, straight away looking at that Philpott, I thought Wayne Rooney.
That's better.
Yeah, so I've got...
Just a Man United legend.
Yeah, up front we've gone for Philpott, Cantona and Rooney.
That's an attack. Oh, I thought you thought it over the top of your head then. That makes it less impressive. And also there's older ones of Rooney with grey hair.
In the advert, yeah. All right. Not from the side, though.
I thought you thought it off
the... I did think of it off the top of my head.
No, you didn't, because you already had
it. Well, I'd put that together and then off the top of my head I was like, oh, well, that looks like Rooney.
No, pre-planned.
No.
And now it's time, ladies and gentlemen, for...
The Cult of IMACP.
It's got the cackle, isn't it?
Yeah, no, I was going to throw to him.
I just did.
So rude.
The Cult of ICMAP.
So yes, Dan, what do you have lined up for us this week with the application to the Cult of IMAP?
Okay, application number one. I'm going to play it through. I believe this is from Honey.
That's the person who runs the Reddit.
Oh, nice.
Hello, Tom, Ben and Dan. This is my application to join your cult. As you may or may not know, I run your subreddit. Therefore, I already have experience with running a cult. Maybe I should be applying for the role of cult leader. If one of you gets brutally killed, I can step in. You also have to have me in the cult because I have autism. If you don't have enough diversity in your cult, people may kick off.
That's smart.
And you don't want that.
She's got us in the headlock.
I'm also part Italian and can make the most incredible pizzas. Free pizza for eternity in the cult.
Ooh. You're in.
I hope
you're
you accept my application. And if you don't, there will be war as I will start a rival cult and turn Reddit against you.
Oh, wow. Honey.
Let me in.
You're in.
Honey, you're already in before the threats, honey.
Let me in.
I got pizza. That's, I mean, she had us because we had to, you know, be inclusive, then the pizza, and then the threats. So, yes, honey, you're already in. I mean, you're already in for just running the subreddit, which everyone should check out, by the way, the subreddit, ICMAP. I'm now a mod.
Oh, congratulations.
I thought I was a rocker, but it turns out I'm a mod.
That is good.
But no, it's lovely over there. Why don't I go check it out? There's a lot of interesting conversations over there as well. So,
honey,
check.
Welcome.
Welcome, honey.
Let's go to the next one, shall we? This looks like it's from Reagan. Here we go.
Ooh, great name.
Your top name.
Good weapon.
Hello, lovelies. How are you all doing today?
Hello.
I'm Regan. I'm a bartender slash mixologist from Watford. Beautiful little space.
Sandwich artist.
And my skills, I think, need no introduction. I can make you all lovely little cocktails.
Sounds like
Bloody Marys, my favourite. Death espresso martini.
Ooh.
If you know, don't swing that way. Nice sex on the beach for all of us lovely little lovers. If you want to put a little extra something spicy in the cocktails, a little bit of arsenic, any kind of poison, on your guard. Do it on the slide, get rid of all of them. It's me,
all of them.
Dan, Ben, and the other one. Easy.
Ease out.
I make small cocktails. Have a good time. Well, I'll see you guys later. Listen to you guys later. It's all right.
Somebody got to say no there, all right?
Well, I like him. He's got character.
I don't know if he says he's going to kill people, right? So,
yeah. Don't know. Come on in. Come on.
Yeah, Regan.
I was enjoying it.
You're the least forgettable one out of the three of us, I would say. Not according to Regan, but...
No, according to Regan.
Yeah. No, I like it. Yeah. Love the sex on the beach.
Chance me if I think. I like the death espresso martini. Yeah. It's good.
Yeah. No, I like him a lot.
So you guys, if you guys want him in, he's in.
Yeah, I don't want him to, you know, it's Tom. His name's Tom.
I mean, he obviously didn't mean to forget.
Yeah, he meant well.
By the way, I think he's doing it because he was like, Tom.
Yeah.
it's our thing. Okay.
Should we do one more?
Yeah, one more.
Regan and Honey, get to know each other. You're both in.
Congratulations. This one is from Phoebe.
Hello, hello, hello. This is Phoebe from Devon.
Hi, Phoebe.
I love the show, guys. It's great.
Thank you.
This is my application to the cult. I've had many jobs, but one of my favourite jobs I've had is I worked in a craft beer shop. I pride myself on my knowledge of beers, and I think I could certainly supply the cult with the best, most top-notch craft beer ever.
We've got beer and cocktails.
And we could enjoy some real proper beer. I also work in an aquarium.
That's cool.
Knowledge of fish.
Yeah.
So there's that.
It used to be pesky.
That's good.
I think I'd be a great addition to the cult. Yeah. Let me know.
Great.
I mean, Ben, you wanted to do your James Bond fish tanks, didn't you?
Yeah, yeah. I've got the tank. I've backed out of the idea. But yeah, that's great. Well, we can give her the tank.
Yeah, the aquarium's more interesting than the craft beer. To me.
Have a craft beer while watching.
Looking at fish. Looking at lovely fish.
Yeah. I mean.
Yeah. Well, so that's Phoebe and Honey in the cult.
Phoebe, Honey, and Regan.
Oh.
Regan, you're in, mate.
Sorry, the other one. Sorry.
Oh, there it is.
Whoosh. Whoosh. For people, all the listeners, I was doing the header. Heading the ball into the back of the net. So, guys, after those, Dan, I think what we're going to do is, if you don't, maybe you don't feel comfortable applying to it, you don't know how to list, it's just your skills. We're thinking this could also be a bit of a kind of spooky story or a bit of a, if you've got some links to a crime or anything like that, like any kind of interesting true crimey aspects to your life or even funny stories. We basically want to learn more about our audience as well. And even if you have a question that you're dying to ask, even that would be fine.
Yeah, yeah. Probably, if you can, keep them between sort of 1 and 2 minutes long. That's the golden spot. It's a hot spot, isn't it?
That is true, yeah.
But another way, if you want to get like the fast track into the cult, then why not head over to icmap.co.uk. It's the brand new home of I Could Murder a Podcast.
It sure is, Ben.
Over there, you can get your hands on exclusive merchandise that will not be available anywhere else. Tom's repping the hat right now.
I'm repping the mug as well.
Dan's repping the mug. Where you can get exclusive cult merchandise. It's all black, which is a great vibe, isn't it?
Yeah, it's like New Zealand.
As well as that, you also unlock almost 100 exclusive episodes, completely ad-free.
Yes, indeed. And also, we have two tiers over there. If you join the prestige tier, which we've had a lot of people join, which is great.
Bloody lovely.
You can join our Discord, Ben, which would mean we struggled with Reddit.
Yep.
Discord, we're starting to find our way, and it's really nice, isn't it?
Taken like a duck to water in...
Have you?
In Discord, and yeah, I've been waving to people. I've been uploading photos. I've done a couple of photos. Yeah.
Nice.
Just welcoming people, you know.
Yeah, and
look how busy our Discord is. It's crazy busy. It's
cracking on. And also, we're going to be doing
there's me.
And we'll also be doing a monthly live stream over there as well. Yes. So, and I know money is tight for some people, so the monthly subscription might not be for you right now, but there is merch on the store as well. But also that website is just where we house our merch now. So if you want to check out the new merch, then why not go over there?
Yeah, and any support is greatly appreciated. It goes straight back into the channel. The other really amazing thing you could do is just tell your friends about us, or give us a like if you're an audio listener, subscribe if you're a YouTube viewer, and just tell bloody everyone about us, because we would appreciate that loads.
Yeah, we're trying to get... Well, I'd like to be... hit 40,000 by the end of this series.
That'd be lovely.
We're not too far off it. We've been edging closer and closer to that number. It'd be great to hit that number.
We thought we were shadow banned for ages, didn't we? We
did think we were shadow banned, but apparently we're not. But yeah, it'd be great to see those numbers on the rise. We're just not growing. But yes, yeah, we're trying to grow our YouTube page as much as possible. And yeah, the listen numbers are great. So thank you so much for all the support and sharing and spreading the word.
Yeah. To stay in the loop of all things that are going on in our world, why not follow us on our socials, which is at Could Murder a Pod. We've got Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, TikTok. We're bloody everywhere. And also, if you follow us on any of those platforms, you will be well and truly in the loop in terms of the audience vote, which is not too far away.
It really isn't.
Please vote for the Costa Concordia
or Ted Bundy. If you want to do Ted Bundy, why not Ted Bundy? I'm just saying Ted Bundy because Ben really doesn't want it, and a lot of people vote for it usually. So do what you want, guys. I really don't care. You pick the case, we do it.
Yeah, I'm a bit more preferential on Costa Concordia, but because I got the jumper and everything.
Anyway, guys, thank you so much for your support, and we'll be back again next week with a fresh new case. But like we always say,
we say this all the time,
keep doing what you're doing.
Well,
unless you're applying for the card, not remembering all our names.
Yeah, well, you still got in.
Let's go with Rocket Dave.
Don't put a caravan by the side of your house, and if you're going to be doing stuff like that. I mean, you can, but...
You can find a caravan, but just...
Yeah, but come on.
The fire was about a bit.
The fire, yeah, then do the rest of it. Paul Q. Oh, he's a bad fucker, isn't he? Bad guy.
Mm.
Really bad man.
Anyway, guys, do it.
Bless you.
Bless him! Just get it back in.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
This Mother's Day, treat mom to healthy, glowing skin with Osea's limited edition skincare sets. Osea has been making clean, seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. Their advanced eye care duo brightens and firms skin around your eyes, while the Golden Glow Body Trio nourishes and smooths skin all over. Go to oseamalibu.com and use code MOM for 10% off your first order site-wide.
I Could Murder a Podcast is proudly part of the Acast Creator Network. For hundreds of extra minisodes and other content, along with our private Discord server and live Q&As, exclusive merch and much more, consider subscribing to icmap.co.uk.